This week on Writers, Inc.
I will draft the book really fast. So I write my drafts in about, people might scream. I could draft a novel anywhere from like 1 month to 3 months, 3-4 months. So that's a draft. And then I go in and then I just start doing that layering process where I just keep going in and adding things, and I have it all in Excel. Or I'll have a checklist like, okay, does chapter 3 have any mention of, like, I don't know, roses or something? And I will go with that in that. Because I want to make sure that, especially in Forgotten Sisters, I wanted it to kind of feel like hypnotic, that as you were reading, kind of like, it was almost like a spell. Like, I wanted you to kind of keep feeling the water. I wanted you to keep feeling the house. And I wanted you to keep feeling the intensity of their emotions and just how trapped they felt for various reasons.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
It's Jenna Brown.
Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc.
Now, I did catch a glimpse of an article that I didn't get to read before it disappeared, but there apparently ChatGPT-5, there's an Android, like a robot, now running that AI.
What? Is this the groping robot? Or no, that was a different robot.
That was in Saudi Arabia, right?
Yeah, that was KevBot.
So is this the body double or the real
Kevtron 2000?
I don't know. Does it grope you? Does that help tell a difference? I don't know.
I'm confused.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Was it programmed with the three laws of robotics?
Oh, that's out the window. They're never going to do that. Robots are going directly into kill mode and take us all out.
Sorry, Asimov. Bye.
Kevin, you're back with a new old podcast, right?
A new old podcast. Yeah, the Wordslinger podcast is back. I announced it a couple of days ago, and I was not prepared for the sort of onslaught of support that I was going to get for that. I really thought people had just kind of forgotten about it. It's been about 4 years since I posted an episode, and I really didn't think I was going to do it again. I was going to move on to something else, and just had this like intuition that I should loop back. And I posted something like on Monday, and I've just had a flood of support for it. So yeah, I'm going to retool it a little, but it's the same vibe. I mean, it's the same show. I think people are going to enjoy it.
So do you start over at episode one, or you just pick up right where?
No, I picked right up. Like almost like I hadn't been gone at all, like episode 226 or whatever, 216, I think. And just kept it going. I'm doing it on Substack, hosting it on Substack. And, I was able to import old episodes, but it only went back to like episode 116. So there's like 115 episodes. I got to figure out how to import. Okay. And it only lets me do one at a time.
Oh, nice.
So
that'll take a while.
That's fun.
Yeah. But anyway, listen to the Wordslinger podcast.
All right. And got so much stuff going on. And Jenna, you're up for an award, right?
Contest. Yeah. I made the shortlist for Uncharted. They do novel excerpts, so you can send up to 5,000 words of an unpublished novel. So yeah, I made the final 15. So
that's awesome.
Cool.
We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Where do I get an absentee ballot? All right, Kevin, what's in the news?
Well, in the news, first up, Gabriel Garcia Marquez's sons are publishing his final novel, which he wanted destroyed. His final novel, Until August, is set to be published later this month. Despite the late author's wishes for the project to be destroyed, Marquez, who died in 2014 after battling dementia, had attempted multiple versions of the novel before deciding to terminate it, a decision communicated directly to his son, Gonzalo Garcia Barca. The novel revealing the story of Anna Magdalena Bach visiting her mother's grave on a Caribbean island and exploring self-fulfillment through illicit affairs represents Marquez's first novel centered on a female protagonist. His sons decided to publish the book after concluding that Marquez lost the ability to judge its quality due to his dementia. They found the manuscript to be better than remembered and believe it to be a valuable addition to their father's celebrated body of work. Marquez, renowned for classics like 100 Years of Solitude, is not the first author to have his works published posthumously or against their wishes, joining the ranks of Franz Kafka, Vladimir Nabokov, whose executors also disregarded their requests for destruction of unpublished manuscripts. What an interesting thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because like, first of all, when you're writing a book, doesn't it feel like it's garbage? Like as you're writing it, like it doesn't feel like it's
every
like,
time.
Yeah. You know, like if you put it aside for a couple months and go back and revisit it, you know, it's usually really good. But, you know, while you're in the mud, it's very different. The guy had dementia in the end, you know, so you don't know what his decision making, you know, skills were like. But, you know, he told them not to do it, you know, that's the part I can't get over. Like whether he was in good health, bad health or whatever, he said, no, please don't do this. And I couldn't go there.
That's kind of like my worst novel. So just saying this on the record, please never publish my first novel, please. It's not good, no matter what you think.
I'm the exact opposite, man. Publish everything, whatever you find. If I wrote something on a scrap of a receipt or something, man, put that out there. Earn that money if you can, Kara. Go out and earn it. Because the way I see it is like, I'm dead. I don't care. And it was something that I had enough passion about at the moment that I wrote it down. Whether or not I think it's good is irrelevant. I think that our work stands apart from the artist. So
quick note for your wife. Kevin's little rant there started at timestamp 9:20 in case you need it for the attorney.
Yes.
On the road.
Yes. Yeah. What do I care? I already went through dementia, so we're good. Next up in the news, in latest AI war escalation, Elon Musk releases chatbot code. Elon Musk's move to open up the code behind Grok is the latest volley in a war to win the AI battle. Grok, which is designed to give snarky replies, styled after the science fiction novel The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is a product from xAI, the company Mr. Musk founded last year. By opening the code up for everyone to view and use, known as open sourcing, Mr. Musk waded further into a heated debate in the AI world over whether doing so could help make the technology safer or simply open it up to misuse. Silicon Valley is deeply divided over whether the coding underlying AI should be publicly available, with some engineers arguing that the powerful technology must be guarded against interlopers, while others insist that the benefits of transparency outweigh the harms. At least some of the posturing around open sourcing is closely tied to business interests, because OpenAI is the market leader offering the most powerful and arguably the most popular chatbot. It has little reason to open its source code.
I think this is fascinating, though. Like, he realized he wasn't competing with OpenAI, so it just was like, here's the code, everybody. Do what you want with it, which is, yeah.
That is an interesting approach.
It is. I wonder if some of the hesitation, though, is, you know, OpenAI, aren't they in a bunch of lawsuits about where they trained with the code?
Yeah.
I don't know, reveal that. I mean, that was my first thought when I saw the article. Like, I wonder if that's why they don't want to. But I don't actually know enough about coding.
No,
to
I don't
know how it works.
But I know part of this was transparency. So you can see where the data is being collected from, at least from Elon Musk's AI. I don't know about OpenAI. So
well, OpenAI is funded by a lot of big corporations at this point, too. They're not really an open source company anymore. So they may not even have the ability to say, yeah, we want to go ahead and release that as open source. It's kind of a scary thing, though, to release it as open source. I mean, I was watching C-SPAN the other day because that's what I do when I'm bored. And they were saying that the U.S. is a leader in AI technology. And I don't know if that's true or not. But now if we're putting our code out there for the whole world to get, you know, anybody, you know, like a C student is now all of a sudden an A student because they've got the best code. And the flip side of this is Grok has got kind of a sense of humor to it, you know? So if this is the one that predominantly wins out, you know, it's almost like getting My Cousin Vinny as your lawyer, you know, we're not getting the, you know, the clean, you know, version of AI anymore. We're kind of getting the one you don't talk about or the one you don't call unless you need to. So yeah, interesting.
Yeah. So we'll remember this moment in history as when AI went snarky on all of this, and we'll know whose fault it is.
The two Utes.
The robots are going to kill you, but with a sense of humor, I guess is how it's going to.
Well, if I got to go.
That's a novel.
Speaking of AI, getting AI to behave and how we can find out when it doesn't. The publishing industry continues its concern about the proliferation of AI-generated fake books, which could credibly mimic authors and compete with genuine publications. Bill Kasdorf, principal at Kasdorf & Associates LLC and a founding partner of Publishing Technology Partners, suggested a solution involving the development of methods to document authentic content and identify content creators' wish to prohibit from AI training, and emphasizing the need for these mechanisms to be tamper-proof or evident. Kasdorf highlights the potential of combining three standards to address this issue. Three, that's an interesting number, almost like laws of robotics. C2PA, or Coalition of Content Provenance and Authenticity, verifiable credentials from W3C, and the International Standard Content Code, or ISCC, which together could embed provenance information, attribute content properly, and bind metadata and rights to digital assets. The ISCC particularly is generated from the asset itself and includes information on metadata similarity, content similarity, and data integrity. This allows for the persistent binding of rights, metadata, and other crucial information, including directives not to use the content for AI training to the digital asset. This proposed solution aims to enable responsible AI use by allowing AI providers to recognize and respect legitimate rights holders' requirements, thereby offering a promising approach to combating the rise of AI-generated fake books in the publishing industry. The three laws of AI.
Yeah, I know that's like a lot of big words, but I was like, we need to talk about this because I thought this would be coming. For people who don't know, especially the Web3 stuff, if you remember days of NFTs, which I don't know what the states of those are now, but it's instead of being single source, it's multi-source verification. So diversified. So lots of people hold that code and can say whether it's authentic, which I think is really interesting. So kind of applying that type of code to books. So we can say, no, this is the authentic book and that can be verified, you know, it's diversified, multiple people can verify that, not one person can tamper with the code. So I thought this would be coming, and I think this is the way that we will be moving, and I think it's much needed. So I just thought it was interesting to discuss.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And I think when I first heard about blockchain technology, which is like that, you know, it starts here, I had actually heard it in terms of being able to trace like E. coli breakouts, you know, where it's like a bag of salad comes out and then they have to do all of it because you're just not sure where it came from. And they were explaining that when you, you know, like put things on the blockchain, you can see like every, you know, every person essentially that touched that bag of lettuce that led to being in your plate. So things can be, you know, sourced and tracked down easier, which I mean, you know, can be good. I can also see that, you know, this is a potential apocalypse in the making, but you know.
You got to get a lot of people to agree to this too. I mean, this is almost like VHS versus beta. You know, like we've got every government in the world's going to have to agree on whatever the standard is. Then, you know, they've got to implement that standard. We just talked about, you know, OpenAI being AI code being released, you know, out there as open source. So now all those players would have to agree and everybody would have to implement basically the same technology. So as wonderful as this is and would be, I don't see all these people coming together on it to actually get it done.
I wonder if they need to come together though, because just like with an NFT, like if you're putting that blockchain, if you're putting it on Web3, you can verify it, you know? So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how this evolves.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, because I think in theory, you would just be able to use the ISBN, right? Like that unique ISBN would then be the starting point for the blockchain data that would then, you know, allow everyone to understand that anything under that ISBN is an authentic and true book by this author.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the group, the company that has to adopt this first, and that would make the biggest difference, is Amazon. Mm-hmm. If Amazon would just adopt some standard, any standard, to prevent people from uploading a fake version of your book or from taking your book and republishing it under their own name, if they would just do 10 minutes of work, I think, then we might actually see this whole thing. We'd see that standard get adopted worldwide by everybody, and we'd see the whole problem disappear.
I mean, the technology is already there, right? Yeah. So it's just like we have to attach these digital receipts that are not changeable and verifiable. So it is a bit of a shift because Amazon obviously is web two. They would have to move to some web three technology. But I mean, people put NFTs up pretty quick. So the technology is there. Yeah.
We have one final story. U.S. publishers filed brief opposing Internet Archive's appeal. Four major publishers filed a brief opposing the Internet Archive's appeal of a copyright case they won in March 2023, arguing against the concept of controlled digital lending. The publishers argue that controlled digital lending undermines copyright law by allowing the Internet Archive to digitize and distribute copyrighted books without permission or compensation. The brief emphasizes the importance of copyright in fostering creativity and innovation, noting that copyright law ensures authors and publishers are compensated for their work, including digital editions. The publishers highlight the thriving market for authorized library ebooks, which have significantly increased access to books across diverse communities without compromising copyright protections. The case raises broader concerns about the impact of unchecked digital distribution on the creative industries, especially in light of emerging technologies like generative AI, which pose new threats to copyright integrity.
So we reported on this a while back. So this is just kind of an update if anyone had listened to this before. The publishers had won their case against Internet Archive that ebooks were not different than regular books and that it was piracy and not a lending library. Internet Archives had appealed it. So the publishers are suing again. And there is a very long brief that if anyone is interested in reading, they can find in the show note link. So still fighting this piracy. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Pirates have existed for a long time.
When you're writing a book, the first draft is the easy part. It's what comes after that hurts. The confusion, the self-doubt, questioning this, questioning that, trying to get feedback so you can feel confident making changes. It's a lot to handle. And that's why I'm delighted to say that this episode of the Writers Inc. podcast is sponsored by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that can make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. From start to finish, everything you need to produce a strong, confident story is at your fingertips. Get instant developmental feedback on plot, conflict, characters, themes, and more through the Story Analyzer. And edit each sentence to perfection with a complete interactive editing suite packed with reports and insights. And that's not to mention additional benefits like private community forums and live members-only support, and writing sessions every single week. It's an incredible place to be for any writer. And listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can take advantage of lifetime AutoCrit Pro membership for one single payment. That's right, no renewal fees. Head to autocrit.com/JD to get yourself a lifetime membership now. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
All right. And with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Cynthia Paleo on. She's a Bram Stoker Award winner who's been nominated numerous times for the International Latino Book Award. She's going to be here to tell us all about her latest novel, which is called Forgotten Sisters, and releases March 19th. Here she is, Cynthia Paleo.
All right. So, Cynthia, you often blend dark, speculative horror with fairy tales and fantasy. What draws you to this unique combination, and how do you maintain that balance between these elements in storytelling?
That's such a great question. So the first stories I was introduced to were fairy tales, not because of what we think as young children in school, but my parents came to the U.S. from the island of Puerto Rico. So they moved to the mainland And they, at the time, they only have a sixth grade education. So they were only able to recount to me the stories that they remembered, which were fairy tales. And so those were the stories I grew up with, like the little golden books, like my dad would get, like that's what he could afford. Like when we go to Aldi for groceries, because that's what we went for groceries. And they would have like a big bin of like little golden books for like a dollar or less. Maybe they were like a quarter. I don't remember. I'm probably dating myself. And so that's what he would buy me. And he couldn't really read them because he couldn't read English, but he would kind of like navigate through the pictures. And as I started learning to read, we would both kind of like recount the story to one another. So they personally, fairy tales just mean a lot to me because that's the first stories that my parents were able to tell me. And then in terms of my blend of detective fiction and crime and horror, I didn't know I was a horror author until I was a journalist for a long time. And I left journalism because it was, I live in inner city Chicago. It's where I grew up. And I used to cover community news and that included crime. And so I stopped doing that because of PTSD. And I still wanted to write. And so I applied to the School of the Art Institute, which is a fancy school. And they said no. And I was like, why? I want to write. And they let me in because I kind of begged. And which I don't think that would happen today. I think that was like an old school kind of thing. Like the dean called me. He's like, get in a cab and come down here and let me know why you want to be admitted. I'm like, I would never see that scenario happening today. And so they admitted me in the fiction writing program. And I only had journalism as part of my application. And while I was there, I took coursework in detective fiction, fairy tales. And I was just completely like enthralled with like the works of Agatha Christie and Borges, Poe. And I think that's kind of where my blend of horror came from. I didn't know what type of writer I was until I started writing stories. And my graduate advisor was like, you're a horror writer that doesn't know she's a horror writer. And I was like, is this a bad thing? She's like, no, lean into it. Go. And I loved horror movies. And I kept that a secret for a very long time. I didn't really share that with a lot of people. I would watch horror movies with like my dad, Tales from the Dark Side, Twilight Zone, but like in school I didn't share that. As a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, I was scared to. And I remember after like my husband at the time, I remember when he discovered that I was really into horror, he's like, you've kept this hidden this entire time. And I kind of did because I was scared. I mean, my mother looked at it as a bad thing. And so I had to kind of hide it. But now it's okay to kind of love horror. I mean, it's back then, it was a lot of stigma, I think, around it for various reasons.
Yeah. And so I've seen that you've called yourself a fan of quiet horror. Do you mind defining what quiet horror is and why that specifically draws you in?
I love when you're like in a situation. Like, just think of it like you're out with your friends or you're out somewhere and you're just like, this is really weird. What is happening? And it's just this moment where it's like, everything is kind of normal, but it's not. And it's almost like reality has been tilted on itself. And I think that's what like the Twilight Zone did very effectively. And when things are too over the top, it just feels like it goes into like this goofy area. And that's totally fine. If you like your horror and comedy, that's fine. I've never been a horror and comedy girly. I'm like, I want things to be unsettling. And there's something about maintaining that unsettling consist like that unsettling energy throughout that I think it's so powerful. Like you know, Matheson was able to do that and Bradbury was able to do that so effectively. Yeah. And I just love being in a situation like this is really weird and I can't pick out what's weird about it.
Yeah, that's almost like liminal spaces. Or specifically what came to mind was this one time at like 4 in the morning, it was heavy snow, it was dark outside, and like it was the type of snow that deafened sound around you.
Yeah.
And it was the most uncomfortable feeling of this, like no one else is out here and no one might even hear me if I were to make a noise because the snow itself deafens that sound. So yeah, that's what grabs me with what you're talking about with quiet horror.
See, definitely that. There's something about, and all of us have been in these moments where you wake up in the middle of the night and everything's normal. You're in your house, but something just feels like it's off. And with snow, it's interesting. I've been researching snow for the book I'm writing now. And if you ever notice, like in the snow, when there's snowfall, there's like a smell. Like, but snow shouldn't have a smell. But then I figured this is just like a random tangent with a writer. So random tangents.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it's like the snow is like a pure an air purifier. So if you've ever like feel like you could smell the snow in the air, there's something about it in the air. It's maybe it has something to do with that. I have no idea, but
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting.
And so when looking at these sorts of tense moments or these unease moments, and you have all these other authors that you kind of pull from, that you like their moments. How are you crafting stories? How are you using this when you go to tell your stories?
The unsettlingness. It's funny the way I write. I kind of equate it to like method acting. I'm not precious in the regards that I have to have like a very specific writer routine and the room has to be a certain temperature. Like I could write under any condition, but I'm typically when I am writing, it's typically really late at night and I'm really sleepy and I'm really tired. Because my million children are asleep and my husband and all the dogs we have. And so I usually write when I'm in this like really dreamy sort of headspace. And I think there's something to being in that headspace that allows me to create the narratives that I've most recently been creating. And it's very specific for certain projects. Like certain projects, I'll write them when I'm like wide awake, but like for Forgotten Sisters, I had to write that book like at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 4 in the mornings. I was in this very sleepy, dreamy headspace. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something to it.
And with Forgotten Sisters, you take elements from Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. And we're just talking about fairy tales and how, you've grown up around them. But how do these influence your storytelling? Like, what appeals to you about them and reinterpreting specifically for the Forgotten Sisters, this Little Mermaid into this tale?
It's so sad. And I think we know like the Disney Little Mermaid with Ariel and the red hair and the song and the crab under the sea. But the actual story is so sad. And Hans Christian Andersen's life too is so sad. It's like he dies at the end of the fairy tale. We don't realize like she's dead. And it's so sad to me. And she sacrificed not only her family, but herself because of someone, just someone that she saw that she fell in love with. And she did everything that she possibly could for this person to fall in love with her. And they didn't. They would marry someone else that doomed her to death. And there's just something that was just so tragic about that. Like you get got rid of everything to down to yourself for somebody else, and they couldn't return. Now, there's something too that I think that, almost like, and Forgotten Sisters, I don't want to give it too much away, but at least in the Little Mermaid, the Hans Christian Andersen story, I think there's something to, being, it's a cautionary tale of how much should you sacrifice of yourself? Because, I mean, you can sacrifice all of yourself and still not get what you want.
And it was really eye-opening for me as a queer person to learn that that story is a queer love story, and it's a really tragic one too, because he was in love with one of his friends and they couldn't reciprocate it at that time. And it's a really, really sad story.
Yeah, it's very, and I think that's why so many of the, I mean, he wrote like the saddest fairy tale ever, like the Little Mermaid girl. He would write these very sad things, and a lot of his writings, he would always say, I can't connect with people. I can't, people won't love me back. And it's like, he was queer and he don't want to reciprocate that love for him. And that's so absolutely heartbreaking.
Well, on a completely odd segue, I do want to talk about how Chicago plays a role in Forgotten City and just in your storytelling, because it is your native city. And it like what sort of aspects of Chicago do you find most compelling when you want to explore that in stories?
I remember, I mean, I grew up here. My father came here like in the 50s to the mainland in Chicago, and and then went back and forth, and then finally just kind of permanently said, this is home in the 80s. And so I remember this was a gritty town growing up. Mm-hmm. And Chicago is definitely a neighborhood of like ethnic communities, and where it's not like New York City, where New York is very, but Chicago is very segregated by, like, you can look at the map and just draw on the map where certain ethnic groups live. And it's been like that for a very long time. Blame the dailies for a lot of the ways that they set up the city to design. But I've always found Chicago really interesting for like several reasons. I mean, I'm not bashing New York, but I remember growing up and everything like in the media was like New York, New York. I was like sick of hearing about New York or LA. And then I visited New York and I was like, I don't get it. I just don't get it. And Chicago, I feel like there's really something really interesting here where it's one of the few cities in the country, I believe, where you can just be a working class person and you can live a pretty good life. You can afford a home, you can have your yard, you can have community. And I feel like in other places, and everybody's pleasant here. We still have like this Midwestern identity where people are very, I think we are very caring for one another more so than other places. But then there's a lot of like really weird things that have happened here and a lot of really good things. Like the first reported American serial killer, H.H. Holmes, operated here. Mm-hmm. Al Capone, the largest theater fire in history, the largest, biggest domestic airline crash, Flight 191, over 280 people die here. It's just like, you have like these really big, John Wayne Gacy, we have a lot of serial killers. It's very strange. But then you have a lot of like really fantastical types of things here. L. Frank Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz here at Humble Park. And Walt Disney was born at a house that I could like walk to from my neighborhood. So there's something really interesting about Chicago where there's like a lot of light and dark. And I think that's been reflected. That's reflected even now. I don't know. I love it here. I've visited over like 20 countries in my life. I've been to almost every single major U.S. city and state. I was a flight attendant for a little while when I was in my 20s. And so I traveled a lot. But this is home. And I feel like it has that. It feels like a real place as opposed to other places where I'm like, I don't get the people here.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a really good, I don't know how to describe it, but almost like a really good texture of Chicago in Forgotten Sisters. And you really like put me in this like proximity to water and like near the river, which I haven't had a lot of like Chicago stories that had me feel so close to that. And yet I've been to Chicago so many times and have been close enough to the river that like your story kind of put me in a different place, but still in Chicago. So I'm curious, like how did you intertwine all of these pieces, and how did you really, like, when you sat down to the page, how did you try to reflect Chicago as best you could?
Well, I write a lot of drafts, and so that's part of it. I layer my text, and so the first iteration of this, I kind of wrote it like in 30 days. I sat down and I wrote it. And the first iteration didn't include the detectives. It was just like the sisters that were just kind of airy and bantering. And then as time went on, I just kind of kept going in and layering more. And I really wanted, like, each time I went in to the text, I would think of one element. Like, today I'm going in and it's just the river. I want to make sure that the mm-hmm. river is being felt consistently across. Or the next day I would go in and say, today it's the house. And so I would make sure, and I would go in and layer in elements of the house. And so that's how I write my drafts, where I will draft the book really fast. So I write my drafts in about, people might scream, I could draft a novel anywhere from like 1 month to 3 months. 3-4 months. So that's a draft. And then I go in and then I just start doing that layering process where I just keep going in and adding things. And I have it all in Excel. Or I'll have a checklist like, okay, does chapter 3 have any mention of, like, I don't know, roses or something? And I will go with that. Mm-hmm. Because I want to make sure that, especially in Forgotten Sisters, I wanted it to kind of feel like hypnotic. that as you were reading, kind of like it was almost like a spell. Like I wanted you to kind of keep feeling the water. I wanted you to keep feeling the house, and I wanted you to keep feeling the intensity of their emotions and just how trapped they felt for various reasons.
So something you had mentioned before was that your career in journalism stopped because of this PTSD that you had. Was that in relation to the writing or more of the experiences that you were getting? And how did that impact your future writing? How did you protect yourself knowing that something that is a creative aspect could potentially harm you in the future? Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I grew up in inner city Chicago. And so I went to schools that had like 80, 90% poverty rate. Gangs, guns, drugs were part of the experience of being in schools in the inner city. And so I had a lot of friends that were murdered. I have friends that did murder people in high school and went away forever. And so I remember, it's a very different place, Chicago, at least the neighborhood. I mean, gentrification is a thing and the communities have been displaced and a lot of things have changed. And so it's so interesting now. Like I go and walk at the park with my children and it's the very same park that a classmate was paralyzed in a gun shooting weeks before high school graduation. And so I stopped writing. I remember the last story that I went to cover, I showed up at the park and there was a young man, he must have been like 18 or 19, and he was just released from jail. And he was lying face down with bullet holes in his back. And the police were there. And they were like, well, we had to shoot him. And I was like, because he had a weapon. I was like, well, I don't see a weapon. This is back in 2007, 2007. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't social media the way we have social media. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't do it. And I just remember being so like, and I'm looking at all of the people in the community that came out and saw what they thought they saw. And they were like, he did this. This isn't right. You have to report what happened here. And I knew as a journalist, I was stuck because I didn't see it. I was there in the aftermath. And I called my editor. I was like, there's a lot of tension here between the community and law enforcement. And I cannot deal with this right now. And like my father showed up because my father, it was close to the house. And my dad was crying because he was just like, I remember that kid. He just got out of jail and he had a little kid and he was going to do it. And I'm like, I have to go. I just couldn't emotionally process that. And but I still wanted to write. And so I think right now, at least in horror, there is a really vibrant extreme community, splatterpunk horror, and a lot of people really exploring a lot of these, I just say dark, like really dark themes. And I can't read those things. And I mean, I have brilliant colleagues and that are writing these beautiful things and are really exploring like, you know, complex relationships and incorporating really extreme horror. And I just can't because I've lived so much of these types of things that that's how I protect myself. Like for a long time, I was able to watch extreme horror films like French extremism. I still can watch an extreme horror film, but in terms of reading it, I don't think I can't. I mean, I just can't. Because of my past experience with seeing so much death with youth, especially. So,
yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. on a lighter note, you are the first Latino to have won the Bram Stoker Award. You've also won the International Latino Book Award. How do you think that these recognitions have influenced your career? And what do you hope to see in the broader writing community after breaking through that Stoker ceiling?
It was, I'm still processing it. It was a shock. it was an intense shock. I mean, it was a very difficult year because I was very close to my father and he died in March. And then the Stoker died months later and just a few months, short months later. And I just remember being on stage, like I couldn't process it because I just remember they called my name and all I could think about were all of the nights where I was up late writing, and my dad would call me. He's like, "Hey, did you finish the book? Are you working hard?" And so it was really hard to really, it was hard to enjoy that moment because he wasn't there, because he supported me throughout this. But at least in stepping back now, a few months after, I think it carries a weight with it, because I have to be, I feel like I'm more of a role model than I've ever been before. So it's making me cautious of the projects I take, what I say, what I do, because I feel like it becomes a situation when you're the first in something, it almost becomes bigger than you. And at least for the Hispanic community, the Latino, Latine, Latinx, I want them to be proud of me. And so I don't know what that means. I think I keep doing what I'm doing, and just being authentic. And I think I'm always talking, like, I'm very like positive psychology, and love is like, just, I always want to, you know, talk about love and how we should love and honor and respect one another. But I also want to really bring to the forefront authenticity. What does it mean to tell our stories and to tell the stories that we need to tell? So I think it's a long-winded answer. That's a lot of pressure. I think it's much more pressure now than it's ever been, I feel like, which is scary. And I know that there've been, you know, historically there've been artists that they've reached like this, you know, a major achievement, and it becomes a big weight. But I'm thankful that I have a good family and three dogs and two kids to remind me. Gonna ground you, mom. So you're grounded and centered. But I think it's beyond, I feel like it's beyond me, and I want to make my community proud, but I have to remember that I need to be authentic to myself and write what I need to write.
Well, I hope that it doesn't bear you down. I think the authenticity is the key there. And two more questions. One, Lotería became, it was your MFA thesis, and it evolved into an acclaimed horror book of 2023. Could you discuss some of the key highlights of that story's evolution and what you learned going through that MFA process with this and then turning it into a novel?
One of the things I'm the proudest of is Lotería, because I remember writing it. And so when I went to my, and I don't want to like be mean, because I don't believe in them. But I will say, when I was in my MFA program, I was like the only genre writer. And back in like 2008, at least in the literary scene, genre was looked down upon. And I always remember that people would be like, "Oh, Cynthia writes genre." And I'm like, "I write horror." If you're going to say genre, let's just go and say she writes horror. And so I remember, I'm going to say the story, and if anyone hears it, then it's their fault. At the end of each graduating class would have an anthology. And so each of the graduating members would submit a short story, and it would get published. And I remember they didn't want to publish my short story because it was too gruesome. And so if you look at the anthology, everybody's in alphabetical order, except for mine was like thrown at the very end. And that story is in Lotería. So I think it was Lotería I'm proud of because it was a vindication that I knew what I was doing then, but I was shamed for it. And I was shamed for it because of the stigma still at the time of somebody that, I mean, there's still a stigma of horror and people who write horror, that there's something deviant about us and there's something like not well with us. And I just remember, I mean, my mother would always like drill that type of stuff into me, that you shouldn't be watching this type of stuff, you shouldn't be doing this type of stuff. And now it's like, oh, how's the book going? And so I think I was getting a lot of that. And so to re-release, but when I was working on, I worked on Lotería for throughout the 2 years in my MFA, and I worked on it with Jesse Ball, who was like one of my favorite writers of all time, and Ruth Margraf, who's a playwright. And so I wanted it to feel like Grimm's fairy tale. So I was calling people and emailing people and trying to find all of these like folk stories, Latin American folklore stories to append to like these stories that I was working on. So each of them are based off of a Latin American myth, folklore, or superstition. And one of my indie publishers is like, hey, I keep hearing about Loteria, and it had taken on like this little cult following, and people were like sharing it in chat rooms and Discord. Like, I didn't care. Like, people would email me and be like, hey, you're gonna come up in our book club with Loteria. I'm like, I said, like, up front. They're like, do you mind that we have? I'm like, I don't care. I really didn't care. It was getting read, and that's what I wanted. And my indie publisher Polis got word of that. I was like, you know, this is just being shared around. We should republish this. And I was like, sure. I didn't think anybody would look at it. I didn't think anybody would read it. Because I figured so many people had it for free already. And Esquire named it one of the best of 2023. And of course, winning the Bram Stoker Award, but seeing Loteria get the recognition of something that I wrote over 10 years ago, that told me I knew what I was writing. I knew what I was doing so long ago, but people told me I wasn't doing the right thing. And if anything, that's a testament to, if somebody tells you that you don't know what you're doing, use this example, okay? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I could have stopped. I could easily have stopped writing and, you know, shoved those dreams away, but I kept doing it, and it was nice to see that come full circle. So it was a good moment.
I think that really highlights the whole conversation here about being authentic and really having this grasp on these sort of like older fairy tales and older stories and interblending it with this quiet horror. Like it all sounds like it accumulated together from like stories of old that came into last year. And I think the key for you is just authenticity. But as a final question, what advice would you give to aspiring writers? Maybe those that are interested in exploring the genre of quiet horror or just in general.
I think you have to, read widely. That's always something I'm going to say, especially when it comes to horror. And don't necessarily read all the new stuff. There's a lot of good old stuff. That's actually one of my goals this year is there's only like, I shouldn't say that, people are gonna get mad, I don't care. But like, there's only like really two, three new books that are being released that I have on my to be read. But my goal this year is to go back and just read a lot of things that I haven't had a chance to get through, and a lot of older works, because I think you'll find some really interesting things there. So reading widely, reading outside your genre, reading nonfiction, like essays, talking to people, like actually getting off the internet and talking to people, because you learn so much about human communication and human relationships face to face with people that you can apply to your books. And I think that many of us are searching for, especially in this day and age, connection. And if you can kind of bring that feeling into your books, I think you're going to draw a lot of readers in. And just keep writing. I think this has taken me, I mean, if you put the numbers together, I mean, I started as a journalist like in 1999, and this is what, 2023? The publishing is a long game, and it's lonely, it's isolating, and it's very important to have a supportive group. If you got a partner at home, even better, that supports you, because it's nice to have somebody in the house with you that you can kind of be like, I'm writing, can you help make me food or something? But having good people to support you through these very long, isolating moments of writing are very nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And we'll end it here.
Thank you.
So I thought it was really interesting that she writes tired in this dream state, and that kind of helps her with horror. I was curious what you all thought about that.
I am highly caffeinated when I'm writing.
I tend to write better, draft better first thing in the morning. And I think it's the same thing. I am very slow to wake up. Like, I am not a morning person. I like to ease into my day. And when I pick my computer up and just immediately kind of almost like when I still am not even really aware of what's going on around me, I think I agree with her. Like, you kind of get put in the world a little bit easier. Like, the line between dreams and reality blurs a little bit. And I think that that can sometimes make drafting a little bit easier for me.
I write pretty much exclusively in the mornings. I think probably for about the same reasons, but I have noticed that maybe this ties in, but like if I take a nap in the afternoon, I can get up and start writing again, just as if I'd had a full night's sleep. So I think maybe there is something to this idea of rest.
In that space between reality and dream. And
yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
So JD, if you're writing highly caffeinated, how do you maintain that unsettling energy while you're all pumped up?
Have you met JD?
more and more caffeine, I guess. I just don't stop. I guess she can probably access the creative portions of her brain a little bit better when you're half asleep. That's probably where that's coming from. Because just thinking this through, like I come up with a ton of ideas, like at night when I'm falling asleep, and I make notes of that in my simple note document. So maybe that's what's going on. Like you're able to access that a little bit better. But it's cool to hear that.
I also thought it was interesting when she was talking about her layering process, like breaking down her work into individual elements, like looking at a river or looking at a subdivision. Do you do that kind of thing in your passes, looking at different layers? I know that's something that I do.
No, but I should.
I don't do it on that level, like a specific thing. Like that's a little different. I know a lot of authors that kind of write, you know, like almost like a 30,000 foot view of their first draft. And then they go back through and, you know, a lot of times they may not even include full character names in that first draft. They might just have some kind of placeholder and then they fill it in. And every time you take a pass, you just kind of fill in a little more and a little more and a little more until you get to the end. But that's very unique too. Just, you know, looking at it from the perspective of one thing, because the river in Chicago is huge. You know, that's almost a character in itself, and it can become part of your story for sure. So making sure that it's part, you know, where it needs to be and making sure it's mentioned properly. I get that.
Yeah, I do that not really for like rivers, but often for like dialogue. I'll go through one character's dialogue in one pass and then another one, you know, kind of highlight them just to make sure that they sound consistent. You know, voice, tone, those type of things I'll look for in layered passes, because I find it difficult to kind of multifocus on different aspects at one time in the editing process. I don't know.
I tend to be looking for what that scene or dialogue is making me feel when I'm reading it. Is it the right vibe? Like not necessarily on the level of like, I want everything I write to evoke some, you know, emotion, with every line, but it's more like, is the feeling I'm getting from character A consistent throughout? Like, is that, do I know this person? Am I living in their skin? That's the kind of thing I'll do on multiple passes. Cause I've read stuff that I've written recently. Like normally I'll do a full pass of a book, like beginning to end. And then I'm looping back as I go. So there's not a lot of inconsistency, but this current book, I wrote it and then I took a big chunk of it out and rewrote that chunk. And then I took another chunk out and rewrote it. I've done that like four times now. So this is the most work I've ever put into a novel. And now I'm going back through the whole thing to kind of look for that consistency of voice, I guess.
Yeah. I thought it was also interesting, you know, with her experiences, that there were some things she just couldn't read because of her real life experience, which I completely understand. Is there anything like that for you that you've experienced that you can't read, or something that just bothers you to read?
Stuff with kids, like once you have a kid, you know, like, you know, kids get kidnapped, they get killed in a movie or TV show. Like that didn't impact me at all until I had a child of my own. And like now I can barely stomach to watch it. I fast forward through it sometimes. There's a Jennifer Garner movie called, I think it's called Peppermint. Where at the very beginning, her kids and her husband are gunned down. And she's basically right there when it happens. And like, that has got to be one of the most devastating scenes I think I have ever watched on film. And I think she actually stopped working in thrillers because of it. Like, I think she just couldn't deal with it anymore. You know, just as an actor, she didn't want any part of that. I'm losing my voice too. So if I fade
we'll
out,
find it. We'll look for it.
Another hurdle.
The kids always get me.
And dogs, you know, dogs for
dogs for sure. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like animals, really, of any kind. there's and it just, and it haunts me and stays with me. In fact, just talking about this, I'm going to be lingering on this for days, but like the story of, you know, the current war with, Edison and Tesla, and the way in which he tried to prove that AC was dangerous was by, you know, executing a rogue elephant or something. Yeah. That story has stuck to me for years. Like, it's,
did you watch it on just, Drunk History? Cause if you didn't, you
I'm
really
not
going to
watch it. No, no, I won't. There was a time in my life where, like JD, like that didn't bother me at all. And I would watch it. I don't know what changed exactly, but now it's like, I won't even watch John Wick. Because I know that the dog
it's just the
dies.
First 10 minutes. You can watch it after that. Then it's fine.
I can't
just
do
start
it.
At 11 minutes.
It. I'll have to skip ahead.
Just start 11 minutes.
I'll go to 11 minutes.
All you have to know at minute 11 is that he's pissed because they like, killed his
this
dog.
Guy's really
That's
pissed
all you
off.
Have to know.
Yeah. That's all I got to know. Maybe if I just know it in abstract. You know, there's those things where people will edit TV shows and movies to make them family friendly. You know, they need something like that for people who can't stand to see kids or pets are harmed. Just all of it happens off screen.
Yeah.
I think I have a pretty, I can stomach quite a lot, but I will say I do get really irritated and will stop reading if it's not handled very well. And if I think that it's just, you know, trauma for trauma's sake. If it's not really necessary to the story and it's just pages of, you know, like some things we don't need to be immersed in, you know, just the idea of it is enough. And I think, like, you know, Tanana Rivdu is a perfect example of that. Like, she does a really excellent job at portraying, just giving you the idea that something terrible might happen without going into what is happening, you know, because, you know, she trusts your imagination. So, and I think for Cynthia Pelayo, being able to work with fairy tales lends sort of the same effect. Like, you can kind of tap into some of those darker fairy tales and insinuate what's going on and create sort of that dread without laying it on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know I really struggle with violence passed off as romance. I know Jed and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, why do we need choking and, you know, men of women? I don't like to read that. So that for me is like, no, thank you. That's not romantic.
Yeah. Even some of the emotional manipulation and stuff, like, I just, you know, yeah.
It, yeah, the toxicity, yeah.
If you're going to write about something, I think that, you know, as a writer, you do have a certain obligation to sort of, you know, understand what you're writing and to explore it appropriately and not romanticize things that shouldn't be romanticized. And it doesn't mean that you can't write about it or create these characters that do these things, because I don't think that's the answer. I just, you know, just don't just put it on there just for the sake of having it on there to be edgy or cool or whatever.
It's got to be necessary for the story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also thought it was interesting because this is something I've had experience with, is the ongoing idea of other people looking down on genre. How do you handle that?
Yeah. Oh, so we've all experienced this, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
But that's been going on forever. I mean, like, even like Mary Shelley dealt with that with Frankenstein. You know, first of all, she was a woman, so like that was already a big problem back then. You know, a woman wrote a book. Oh my God. But then she basically wrote a genre book, you know, on top of everything else. And, you know, her husband was trying to be taken seriously, you know, in literature, and felt that like that colored his career. So yeah, this has been going on forever, but, you know, I think if you take a look at the dollar amounts behind genre fiction, you know, it's the leader. You know, romance is out there on top, then thrillers, and, you know, genre has always led the game. So people may not want to talk about it. You know, they'll take their cover from their literary book and put it on top of their genre book they're actually reading. But it's out there, you know, always has been and always will be.
One of the things that happened to me early on is I had someone read my work, and I was like, oh, this is really good. You're actually a literary writer. You should write literary. And I'm like, no, I'm actually a genre writer. I just can write well. Like, there's a difference, you know? It's like, it's not because you have nice sentences that you need to write literary. And that just blew my mind. I'm like, if you think that genre writers can't write well at the line level, let me direct you to like 50 of them and we'll just like discuss this again. So
it is funny. I do, you know, I've never heard a really satisfying like distinction between literary and genre, because a lot of the stuff that people think of as literary that's done the best has ended up being in some way genre fiction. Yeah. And but no one notices, like even science fiction and or like mystical, you know, like fantasy type stuff. So, you know, what game are we playing out here? It's all in the title.
Then they call it literary genre. And you're like, what? It's like, oh, we discovered this genre writer that also literary people like. So now it's moved from the sci-fi shelf to the literary section. You're like, what?
All you got to do is put a literary title on your book. So instead of Star Wars, it's like Worlds of Distant Dispute or something like that. And now that's literary. Yeah.
I remember my husband is a literary snob. And I'm like, I have something for you to read. And I gave him sci-fi, and it was China Mieville. It was Embassy Town. And he went, that was very dense and difficult, but I enjoyed it. And I'm like, yeah, it's not fluff. Like, people think that, I mean, it can be, and there's nothing wrong with that. But, and like, if you're just writing about something that is not just straight up real life, is that genre? I don't know. I don't know what the distinction is.
I think I read somewhere, maybe, I actually don't remember where, but I had thought that the distinction came down to structure. So technically literary fiction tends to be more like interior explorations that may have, I mean, it obviously has a beginning, middle, and an end, but not in the same way. Like, it won't follow plot beats necessarily, where genre has more of a structure as far as where the story is going and what the reader will experience. I don't know if that's true or not. It kind of makes sense. Like, the books that tend to be like very, very, very literary, I don't particularly enjoy. I don't even read a lot. That's been my experience. They meander, they wander, they sort of are like beautifully written, but I don't know what they're about. You know, like, that's kind of my experience with them. They're very easy to get lost in, whereas, you know, a beautifully written genre book, I can still, you know, you don't get lost. Like, there's a purpose and a point, and it follows a structure. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's how I define it.
Yeah. It's like going to a, it's like going to a 5-star restaurant, and you get like, you know, you order your meal, and it's like a cubic inch of steak and one pea.
You know,
because it's prepared by Chef So-and-so. So it's excellent, you know.
And then they spend 45 minutes detailing every step that went into preparing that cube of steak and a pea. And then, you know, and then you're supposed to just, you know, describe everybody, you know. And it's fine. Yes. I know a lot of people like that, and it's fine. I think there's no, you know, everyone should be able to read whatever they want. I just don't particularly enjoy it.
I'm just like, yeah, I actually like literary. Now that you said that, I read like The Year of the Death of Ricardo Reis forever ago. Nothing happened in that book except he walked around the city and it was all interior. I don't know what it was. Well, I kind of know what it was about, but I loved it. But you're right, there was no structure in it. So I kind of like that idea. All right. And with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Carter Wilson on. He's a USA Today bestselling author of numerous psychological thrillers, as well as an International Thriller Award finalist and 5-time winner of the Colorado Book Award. His latest book is called The Father She Went to Find and releases April 2nd.
Fantastic. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.